We'll hear arguments next in Federal Communications Commission 1471 and the related and consolidated cases. Griswold, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, these cases are here on petitions for certiorari to review a decision of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. There are many parties and several issues. All arise out of the ownership of a newspaper and of a broadcast facility, television or radio, in the same community by the same interests. In the terms of the trade, this is known as cross-ownership. The issues here result from an order of the Federal Communications Commission made in 1975 after 5 years of hearings. This was a rulemaking proceeding, and the result is known as the Commission's second report and order. It occupies most of the first volume of the appendix from pages 134 to 338. The rule announced by the Commission was that it would not hereafter grant a new license for a new broadcast license or transfer of license where there was cross ownership. This is known as the prospective rule. But the Commission also determined that it would not apply this rule retroactively. That is, that it would not refuse to renew existing licenses solely on the ground of cross-ownership. This is known as the grandfather provision of the rule. There was, however, an exception to the grandfather rule. In 16 small market situations where there was no other newspaper and no other comparable broadcast facility, the Commission did apply its new rule to existing licensees. It said that they must divest either the newspaper or the broadcast facility by 1980. Numerous appeals were taken to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. The Federal Communications Commission naturally defended its order, but the Department of Justice attacked it. The government speaking with many voices, particularly with respect to the grandfather provision. The Court of Appeals last March affirmed the prospective order, but it found that the grandfather provision was invalid because, it said, it was not rational. It held that because of a compelling presumption, and that's the court's words, in favor of diversity, and again I quote, divestiture is required except in those cases where the evidence clearly demonstrates that cross-ownership is in the public interest. Under the judgment of the court, those portions of the order that have retroactive effect and those portions dealing with existing combinations are vacated, and the record is remanded to the Commission for adoption of rules not inconsistent with the opinion of the Court of Appeals. In this court, there are widely divergent interests. I represent the private parties, newspapers and broadcast stations, and the American Newspaper Publishers Association and the National Association of Broadcasters. Some of my clients are concerned with the prospective rule, and others are primarily concerned with the grandfather question. I am also appearing for the small market situations and also for some newspaper radio combinations, which seem to be at some risk of being lost in the shuffle. I now turn to the validity of the prospective rule. There is a serious constitutional question here. The petitioners, newspapers and broadcast stations, are subjected to blanket exclusion from commission licensing merely because they engage in publishing. The government may not condition the grant of a privilege on the forfeiture of a constitutional right, as in effect this court held in the Simmons case some 10 years ago in a different context.
Mr. Griswold, suppose a television station had broadcasts which were clearly, for the purposes of my question, clearly enough to pass the hurdles of the obscenity decisions of this court. That is, we would not sustain a criminal conviction for what they had shown on the television. Would that be a ground to consider denial renewal of the license at the end of the 3-year period?
That would certainly be a ground to be taken into account along with all the other factors in determining whether the license should be renewed.
Well, how do you square that with the... I'm sure you have a distinction between what you're...
Because we are not dealing here... We are not dealing here with something which says this is merely a ground to be taken into account with all the other factors. Mm-hmm. We're dealing here with a blanket rule which says that if you are in common ownership with a newspaper, you cannot receive a license. Now, whether you get a renewal or not is the question of the grandfather rule, which is the next part of my argument.
Let me change my hypothetical then. The only adverse evidence against the broadcaster is found in the series of broadcasts of the kind I included in my original hypothetical question. And the commission said any licensee which persists in that kind of broadcasting will not be renewed, period. That's
well, that would be precisely this case. That would be announcing a rule that in the case of cross-ownership, there cannot be a renewal. And that, I suggest, is contrary to constitutional provision.
Say one newspaper in a two-newspaper town wants to merge with the other, and let's suppose that the existing statute that allows that in some circumstances hadn't been passed. Does the antitrust laws, do they validly apply to a...
Oh, the antitrust laws clearly apply to newspapers and to television. And in any event where there is a violation of the antitrust laws, as there was in the Lorraine Journal case, which came to this court, the Department of Justice can proceed under the...
The only reason I can't acquire the other newspapers is because I'm a newspaper. Some other company could acquire it.
It would not, as the Lorraine Journal case shows, it isn't just that it's another newspaper. It is the actual anti-competitive effect.
In the news business.
In the news business. In the Lorraine Journal case, for example.
And the government is entitled to insist that there be dispersion in the publishing business, is that it?
Mr. Justice, it is a difference, it seems to me, between the antitrust laws and the influence or weight to be given to anti-competitive effect.
Well, I know, but anti-competitive can't conceal the fact that that we're talking about competition in the news business.
And I'm perfectly willing to concede that the anti-competitive effect can be taken into account, along with all other factors, in determining whether a license should be granted or should be renewed.
The government could, under the antitrust laws, could validly prevent there being only one paper in the town where there had been two before.
I'm not sure of that, Mr. Justice.
Well, suppose that otherwise... Based on antitrust considerations, you would conclude that the antitrust laws would be violated if these
weren't correct. No, I don't, Mr. Justice. There are many cities in this country which have only one newspaper.
Well, I understand.
And
that.
I know of nothing to indicate that that violates the antitrust laws.
Well, I just pose to you, though, the situation where, under ordinary antitrust principles, merger between two papers would violate the antitrust laws under commonly understood antitrust principles. You would say that if that were true, you could prevent the merger of the two papers without violating the First Amendment.
Yes, Mr. Justice. If it does violate the antitrust laws, and I know of nothing in these cases which indicates that any of these interests has violated the antitrust laws.
Well, I know, but then in that case, the government is saying there must be two newspaper voices in the city.
And that is applying the same law to newspapers that applies to every other kind of business in the country, whereas this rule applies only to newspapers and applies a rule which is much more stringent.
You wouldn't say then that the antitrust laws could validly prevent all the press, all the newspapers, and all of the television stations in the city merging?
Well, I assume that that would violate the antitrust laws.
Even though you have television stations as well as newspapers?
I thought you said all the newspapers and all the television stations merging.
I did.
Well, that under many circumstances would violate the antitrust laws, and I'm not contending that newspapers are not subject to the antitrust laws. I am contending that they cannot validly be made subject to a blanket rule based simply on the fact that there is cross-ownership.
Mr. Griswold, let me ask the other side of this same coin. Do you know how many communities in this country have more than two newspapers?
No, Mr. Justice, I do not. Not a great many.
Not a great many, and hence we do deal with a product of scarcity even on the newspaper side.
Even on the newspaper side. Washington at the moment has two newspapers. In Buckley against Vallejo, this court said that the concept that government may restrict the speech of some elements of our society in order to enhance the relative voice of others is wholly foreign to the First Amendment. This is a sort of never-never land, as Justice Stewart pointed out in the Democratic National Committee case. Here, the First Amendment, designed to protect press freedom, is used to restrict the press. And this is done to enhance the First Amendment value of diversity in broadcasting.
Well, do you think the Commission saw its source of authority to require diversity in the First Amendment?
I'm not sure that the Commission did it only there. The Court of Appeals certainly did. The Court of Appeals said that this was a presumption was compelled in order to carry out First Amendment values.
It said about the same thing in Buckley against Vallejo.
Yes.
It said about the same thing in the Democratic National Committee
case. National Committee case.
Same court.
There's nothing in the amendment about diversity, just freedom. And there's a further paradox. The regulations here were intended to affect more than broadcast media, and they can have no effect on diversity in broadcasting. Looking only at broadcasting, there'll be no more diversity after these amendments rules are in effect than there was before. There'll be just as many voices.
Well, hasn't diversity been a factor in the decisions of the Commission for 50
years?
Yes,
Mr. Justice, Mr. Chief Justice, and I'm quite clear that diversity can continue to be a factor, but not the controlling factor. Not the one which makes a controlling presumption in the face of which everything else must yield. The First Amendment...
When you have a half a dozen considerations, how do you really determine which is the one that broke
well,
the camel's back?
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, the closest analogy I've been able to think of, I suppose based on my past experience, is the problem of the Backe case. What do you do when you have more applicants than you can handle? You take into account a great many factors, and you come up with your conclusion. And that, it seems to me, is what is involved here. Diversity is an appropriate factor, but it is not appropriate to make it the exclusive factor, which the Court of Appeals did below. The First Amendment is a shield, not a sword, to promote diversity. But the Court need not resolve this constitutional question. Just as in Halvering against Griffiths, it held that in the absence of a clear statement by Congress, it need not decide whether stock dividends are constitutionally subject to income tax. And I may add that Congress has never made that decision, and stock dividends are not subject to income tax. By any analysis, the prospective rule is clearly a legislative action which can only be supported by an adequate delegation from Congress. It is my contention that Congress has never made any such delegation. In addition to the constitutional doubt, we have the fact that a ban on cross-ownership is a fundamental exercise of governmental power, affecting important aspects of our free society and involving a substantial change in the practice over the past half century. There's room to argue, I think, that such a fundamental change, going beyond radio and television and reaching into the printed press, is one which should be made or authorized by representatives of the people in Congress, and that authority to make such a change should not be inferred or surmised. Now, in our briefs, we have discussed the nature of the authorization. All that has ever been given to the Commission was given to it in 1934, when it was given power over communication by wire or radio, not power over newspapers. And it was also given authority to grant licenses if public convenience, interest, or necessity will be served thereby. Language obviously taken over from the traditional public utility statutes without any thought of newspapers. Moreover, we have some legislative history, which is pretty good, detailed in the newspapers. In particular, in 1952, the Senate passed a statute affecting the powers of the Communications Commission. The House amended that statute with an explicit provision saying you don't have any power over newspapers. The exact language is quoted in the brief. It went to conference, and the conference took out the House amendment. But the conference committee issued a report in which it stated that this was taken out because it was unnecessary, that the commission did not have any power over newspapers.
How much weight can we attribute to what the 1952 Congress thought as to what the 1934 Congress meant?
I would suggest, Mr. Justice, that that isn't what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with what the 1952 Congress did. The 1952 Congress, many times committee reports have been used to establish the intention or meaning of an act of Congress. And in the hierarchy of committee reports, conference committees are the very highest. And here we have a conference committee report clearly dealing with this question, after which both houses passed the statute and the president signed it. And I would suggest that it isn't language in the statute, but it is the closest to it that you will ever find. And it is not simply a case of subsequent members saying, well, we didn't mean so-and-so, back there in 34. Well, now I must turn to the grandfather question. The action of the commission making its new rule inapplicable to existing licensees, except in certain small market situations. The court below has held that the commission could not, in the court's word, rationally reach the conclusion in favor of grandfathering. And it is held, apparently based on First Amendment values, that there is a, quote, presumption in favor of divestiture, close quote, which must be given, quote, controlling weight, close quote, so that, quote, divestiture is required except in those cases where the evidence clearly discloses that cross-ownership is in the public interest. And the court expressly recognized that its pronouncement was a, quote, court-approved policy. And it remanded the case to the commission for adoption of a rule not inconsistent with its opinion. In doing this, the court violated proper standards of judicial review because it is not its function to tell the commission what rule to make. For example, if the commission knew that it could not use the grandfathering technique in this area, it might decide that no rule at all is preferable. That's a matter for the commission, not the court. But the court below has decided that divestiture is required, except on an affirmative showing of public interest. In essence, this is the question which was decided by this court 6 years ago in the Democratic National Committee case. There, the court below held that the commission must make a new rule requiring licensees to accept editorial advertising on the same general ground. This court held that there was no such constitutional requirement and that courts should not freeze the commission's necessarily dynamic process into a constitutional holding. But this is precisely what the court below has done here. It has required that a specific rule be adopted because, in the court's view and words, the First Amendment's search for truth will be facilitated by governmental policy that facilitates diversity. There is no basis, I think, upon which this conclusion can be supported. I am supported with respect to the grandfather argument by counsel for the Federal Communications Commission, and I think that I will leave most of the rest of the argument to Mr. Armstrong. But this court has held in the Idaho Power case that the selection of appropriate policies in carrying out a statute is an administrative and not a judicial decision. And in Board of Trade against the United States, a good many years ago, the court said, we certainly have neither technical competence nor legal authority to pronounce upon the wisdom of the course taken by the commission. Now, there are two remaining issues to which I can give only brief consideration. In its final order, the commission listed 16 situations to which it did not apply the grandfather rule. These are 7 cases where there was co-ownership of the only newspaper and the only television station in the community, even if there were radio stations in the community. There were also 9 situations where there was a single newspaper and a single radio station, or a combination of AM/FM radio stations. These situations have been called egregious cases, but I think that's too pejorative. They may more accurately be called small market cases. The Court of Appeals set aside this portion of the Commission's decision, and in this respect, the Court's decision should be sustained. The Court of Appeals was correct in holding that, quote, the record contained no evidence that justified the disparate treatment of the 16 affected combinations. And the Commission itself said that the rules are not in the least premised on the existence of improprieties in the operation of the media holdings.
Counsel, if we're talking about rules, why does there need to be any reference to a record? The commission can make a rule without having any record before it, can't it?
That is certainly is a nice question. I would suggest that a rule which is applicable to only 16 instances out of hundreds is not really a rule, but necessarily involves what amounts to an adjudication with respect to those 16 instances. For example, in some of these cases, there's cable television. In one of the cases where there's a newspaper and a television station, there are 7 radio stations in addition, separately owned in the community. And all of those things, it seems to me, should be taken into account. This question of the small market cases is dealt with more fully in the red-covered brief. Finally, I would say that This dog has a very small tail. There are a few situations of cross-ownership of a newspaper and radio station where there are other broadcasters, television or radio, in the same community. These were not covered by the commission's order because of the grandfather clause. However, should the court uphold the Court of Appeals in saying that the grandfather clause is invalid, then they would be swept in. But the position is made in the blue and the green brief that radio is different from television, that there should be separate consideration to the question whether the rule should apply to radio and where there is only radio or television, and there are other voices in the community. And my position is that care should be taken to see that these newspaper radio combinations are not just caught up in the draft and carried away. Our basic contention is that the commission had no authority to make any rule in this area, either for constitutional or statutory reasons, but that if it did have such authority, it did have power to make the grandfather provision.
Mr. Armstrong.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The Commission's fundamental position in these consolidated cases is, first, that our prospective rule is a rational exercise of our rulemaking authority grounded in the public interest standard of the 1934 statute. And secondly, that our refusal to apply the new policy against additional co-located newspaper broadcast combinations to existing combinations, except in certain of the small market cases, is rational and was adequately explained in the second report and order. On the first contention at the outset, I believe a question came up as to whether the Commission felt that the First Amendment was the source of the prospective rule. I will concede that I think the Court may find some language in the Commission's second report and order in which the Commission said that what we are doing here is consistent with the objective of the First Amendment to encourage a number of speakers. But I would not stand on the First Amendment constitutionally compelling the Commission to have adopted the prospective rule. Instead,
or authorizing.
Well, I think, Mr. Justice White, that it is authorized by the Public Interest Standard in the Communications Act.
Which is what? An interstate commerce? Is that an interstate commerce basis?
It is the standard that, among other considerations that the Commission can take into account in allocating spectrum resources, is a policy of diversity. And that is one component of the public interest.
And that's based on Congress's authority over interstate commerce.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I understand your question. In applying that diversity component of the public interest standard, the courts, both the Court of Appeals and this Court's dictum in the 1959 RCA case, have long recognized, and Dean Griswold conceded this, that one of the relevant factors the Commission can take into account in deciding how to allocate spectrum resources is whether the applicant before it has ownership interests not only in other broadcast stations, but also in newspapers. So, and I believe, Mr. Chief Justice, you may have alluded to this, as we view this case, the real question in this case raised by the prospective rule is not a First Amendment question. It is whether the Commission has rationally, in applying the public interest standard of the Act, reached the position where it's ready to announce that this one relevant factor is now going to be determinative. I might say it's not determinative in an exceptional case which might warrant a waiver of the rule, but for purposes of argument, since that is admittedly an exceptional case, we'll proceed on the assumption that we've said it's going to be determinative. And the Commission would respectfully submit that that is not a case of first impression before this Court, because prior to the adoption of the multiple ownership rules that were before the Court in the Stora Broadcasting case in 1956, If an applicant owned seven AM radio stations, for example, and was applying to the commission for an eighth AM radio station, presumably it would have been recognized that in applying the diversity policy and passing on that application, the commission could certainly take into account the fact that the applicant already owned seven AM stations. But the argument prior to this court's decision in Stora, which the Court of Appeals in the Stora case had accepted, was that the commission could not make that one fact determinative and would instead be able to deny that application only after a full hearing in which the applicant could submit all of the so-called other relevant factors the applicant wished to consider.
How much weight could the commission give if an applicant had only four television stations, but their market area came into play?
Well, I believe I understand, Chief Justice, that your question is, suppose the commission was to change the present rule, which says there's a limit of five VHF stations, to try to change it to four. If the commission were to do that, I think we would argue that that kind of line...
Well, what I had in mind was four stations in New York City, Newark, Trenton, and Philadelphia, something like
I
that.
I think the closer the location, the easier a job the commission would have in convincing a court that its public interest judgment was rational. Yes, sir. I wouldn't want to say that we couldn't argue for a different limit even if they weren't close together, but that's clearly relevant, and that was my point in this case, that just as it was a rational public interest judgment in Stora to finally reach a judgment that 7 a.m. stations is it, subject to a waiver, and this court said the commission, once it reached that judgment, could announce its judgment in the form of a rule, and the court reversed the Court of Appeals in Stora. We're saying to you that the point has now come, and the commission has rationally explained why it feels it is now in a position to make the fact that an applicant for a new license or a transfer, the fact that that applicant is a newspaper owner, we're now ready in the application of our licensing experience to say that that is going to
be
determined.
The case isn't over if we agree with you on that, is it?
No, sir. And I'm saying that we have to still defend our grandfather rule, if that...
Well, no, I mean...
the statutory authority point?
We can't agree with you. You can't win this case without our deciding the constitutional issue, can we? Position may be a very rational application of the public interest standard and still barred by the First Amendment.
Well, we read, Mr. Justice White, the NBC case to give us...
Well, anyway, you are going to argue the constitutional issue.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you.
But if we are acting within our statutory authority, and in a moment I would like to discuss Dean Griswold's reference to the 52 legislation, but if it's within our general rulemaking authority under the 34 Act, and if the public interest judgment is rationally explained, and if that leads us to a decision to deny an applicant a license, it is our position that that applicant has not had his First Amendment rights violated any more than the applicant for the 8th AM radio station would not have his constitutional rights violated if, in applying that rule that was upheld in Stora, we turned his application down. Now, as to the point of the statutory authority and the reference to the...
You mean we can just cite that case and as authority for the constitutional question presented here?
We read that case as saying that in applying the public interest standard, if the commission rashly concludes that an applicant's going to not receive a license, that the applicant cannot complain because of the fact that as a result of not getting a license, his first...
So your answer is yes, that's a...
Yes, sir. We're relying on NBC for that point as dispositive. On the statutory...
Well, Dean Griswold's argument, at least part of it, was different, and that is that this imposes an administrative inhibition on newspapers.
Mr. Justice Stewart, we view this...
Over which, first of all, the commission doesn't have statutory jurisdiction, and secondly, it introduces a new First Amendment argument.
We do not ground this case in any way upon any asserted statutory jurisdiction over newspapers.
But that's the impact of what the commission
did. The ultimate bottom line in the case, as we see it, is whether spectrum resources have to be given to an applicant. And we would say that this court in the dictum in the 1959 case and the Court of Appeals in the McClatchy and Clarksburg cases has recognized that a newspaper, the status of an applicant as the owner of a newspaper, is relevant for the commission to consider in deciding whether to give that applicant a broadcast station. So we don't, as I tried to say at the beginning, think that there's any new First Amendment issue because of the newspaper status of the applicant injected into this case. It's really just a question of whether the commission has now reached the point in the application of its licensing experience. Well, to put the point differently, suppose the commission hadn't adopted this rule, and we had gone through the formalities of the process that Dean Griswold has urged that we should go through case by case for the next 30 years. And it just so happened that when this court reviewed what had happened after the next 30 years, you would find that in every single case, the commission said, in applying our accumulating insight and experience, we reached a judgment that the relevant factor of the applicant's newspaper ownership is now going to be determinative. Application denied. Really, that would be no different a situation than the situation we have now. The only difference is the commission has simply announced in advance that its attitude is such as that there would be a denial.
But you did single out newspapers.
Well, Mr. Justice Marshall,
I mean, for example, a person, the owner can own General Motors, the Atlantic Steamship Line, Amtrak, Four Bars and Grills, Chase National Bank, that's okay.
Mr. Justice Marshall.
But newspaper, no.
Excuse me, sir. You're quite correct in your statement of what's happened. Our answer would be that the commission is even-handedly and rationally applying a relevant public interest policy of diversity. And I would have to concede to you that by its very nature, that is the kind of policy which will have more bite as far as a newspaper or another broadcast station is concerned, than it would as far as the owner of Amtrak is concerned.
They'll all agree on the bite.
There's no question about that by its very nature, the policy is going to hurt a newspaper applicant's chances more than it will hurt the owner of Amtrak's chances if he wants to get a license.
It's just not neutral at all.
But
you're not neutral, are you?
I think that the policy of, if it could be characterized as that, it nevertheless is not a grounds for striking down what we've done, because the diversity policy would seem to me by the tenor of your question would fall, and that's been recognized.
I still don't see where you get jurisdiction over the newspaper owner.
We do not have jurisdiction over the newspaper owner. We have jurisdiction over the newspaper owner only when the newspaper owner comes to the commission and asks for a license, which is what we do have jurisdiction over, the allocation of a radio license.
But, I mean, do they have to set out all these other things?
Excuse me, sir?
The owner, the proposed owner, does he have to set out everything else he owns?
Well, I do not want to get drawn into a detailed discussion of the commission's ownership reporting requirements, but I think we do require and are moving increasingly to acquire increasing annual reports about other ownership interests they may have. And certainly we could tell from an applicant being before us, I think, whether or not the applicant was a newspaper owner or the owner of Amtrak.
Well, this is aimed at newspapers.
No, sir, it
I don't
is.
I say I didn't get away from it.
Well, the actual wording of this regulation, yes, sir, it is. On its face, it
and
is.
And doesn't that violate the specific provision of that committee report?
That was the point I was coming to.
Now, before you get to that, we've said, I think, on a number of occasions here, and other courts have said it, that the First Amendment is not confined to newspapers or publishers. It belongs to everyone. But suppose you had a broadcast license available, and one of the bidders was Amtrak, and the other one was a responsible, reputable newspaper. Would not the inquiry give great weight to the newspaper's experience in journalism as distinguished from Amtrak's lack of experience in that field?
As I understand it, you're saying that would, in that case, his newspaper ownership would actually work in his favor.
Because it shows their experience.
Yes, sir. On the other hand, I would have to concede that consistent with the longstanding commission policy, as reflected, for example, in McClatchy, under the diversity policy, it would cut the other way. And how the mix
but
would
if
come
there's
out
only one newspaper.
On an individual
a newspaper
case.
A newspaper that had no other stations and
well,
no other.
Under those circumstances, it's quite conceivable that the weight in favor of the experience factor that you mentioned would outweigh whatever demerit the applicant would suffer under the diversity criterion. On the statutory authority point, we have two arguments. And the first one was suggested by Mr. Justice Rehnquist, and that is we think for the reasons that I have gone through that the 34 statute, the public interest rulemaking standard authority given to the Commission in Section 303, as interpreted by this Court in Stora, is sufficient to answer the case, and that the Court should not give much, if any, weight to the subsequent legislative history that was relied on by Dean Griswold. But if the Court is disposed to take into account subsequent legislative history, we'd call the Court's attention to the 74 statute. In 52, as was recognized in the argument, neither House actually, well, the House of Representatives had, but in the final analysis, it was just a conference committee report and there was no legislation in that. But in 74, the Congress was fully aware of the Commission's outstanding rulemaking proceeding, which is now before this Court. They followed it closely, and there was interchange between the Commission and the Congress concerning the evolution of that proceeding. And each House went on record with a legislative bill in 1974, which we would respectfully submit simply is inconsistent with the notion that Congress in 1952 had denied our authority in this area. The House of Representatives said, whatever it is you're going to do in your outstanding proceeding on the basis of newspaper broadcast cross-ownership, do it in a rulemaking proceeding, and also finish that rulemaking proceeding by a date certain. The Senate took out the first provision, but also passed a provision saying, in this outstanding proceeding you've got proposing a rule to ban future newspaper broadcast cross-ownership, finish it by a certain date. And although the two houses, the different versions, were not reconciled and no legislation ever emerged, we do think that the 74 history would remove any possible conclusion that in 1952 our general rulemaking authority had been cut down. To turn to our case before this Court as a petitioner, it is our argument that the distinction between the prospective and retroactive rules is a rational one and was adequately explained in our opinion. In the case of the prospective rule, the Commission, admittedly operating on the presumption that it was more realistic to expect true diversity if you did not have common ownership, decided to give that consideration determinative weight, even though we recognized, and the Court below recognized this, that there was no guarantee that the more diverse viewpoints would result if we did have separate ownership. But the Commission said, under these circumstances, where you're a prospective rule, where you're not talking about other countervailing considerations, we think the one reason that we had once had for allowing that is no longer determinative. In other words, we can have a pool of other people coming forward. We no longer have to rely upon a newspaper owner to get service started. And so under those circumstances, even though the gain in diversity may be slight, it may be only hoped for in great many cases, nevertheless, where there's no real cost on the other side of the balance wheel, we're going to give it determinative weight.
What happens if a newspaper in Baltimore wants to buy a radio television station in Washington?
If it would depend on the contour of the radio station in Washington, whether or not it would place a certain contour over the city of Baltimore. I don't think it's by any means compelled from this rule that it couldn't be done. In fact, let's make this point very clear. This is not a total ban against new newspaper owners coming into broadcasting. If it's just to take an easier case, if it's Richmond, Virginia, then for sure the Baltimore newspaper would be able to be eligible to apply for a radio station in Richmond.
That's why I didn't pick Richmond.
Well, you've picked a case that would require some detailed application of the standards of the rule, and I wouldn't know right offhand how it might come out.
It has to do with the city signal or something.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. A specified signal over the community of Baltimore. Yes, sir. The other considerations that were present in the case of a retroactive rule, which did not, in our judgment, outweigh the presumed gain in diversity that would have resulted from applying the rule across the board, were first that a broader divestiture rule of the sort that was advocated by the respondents National Citizens Committee for Broadcasting, would have swept out proven licensees with long records of meritorious service. The commission pointed out in, I think it was paragraph 109 of the second report in order, that these licensees, many of them, had been there from the time the station was first established. And there was a study in the record that hasn't been disputed by, I believe, Mr. Robbins, saying that the particular newspaper licensees had shown by their action a much greater long-term commitment to broadcasting than had been true with others. So the commission was confronted with the fact that it was going to have to get rid of a class of licensees who included licensees with
Mr.
outstanding
Armstrong,
records.
How many of the members of the class that are preserved by the Grandfather Clause fit that definition?
Well, Mr. Justice Stevens, every member of that class, it can be said of that member that its record has been before the commission at every 3 years at renewal time, has been passed upon by the commission, and has been found to be in the public interest. And the commission characterized, generally speaking, the record of the class as a group as meritorious.
And your argument isn't that it includes some specially well-qualified stations, but that everyone in the class has proven his entitlement to a continued license.
Well, it's true
well,
that's
true about every licensee in the country, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
One or two exceptions. Every licensee has had his license 3 years or more.
Yes, sir. But in the case of these, though, it's been passed upon by the commission at three-year intervals and is found to have been serving the public
interest. That's true about every licensee in the country, with one or two notable exceptions.
Well, I think in the case of these licensees, generally speaking, Mr. Justice Stewart, they have been in there longer. As I said earlier, a lot of them have been in there since the beginning. So there's been much longer continuity of service in their case than is the case with a lot of other licensees, although it is true that the great value which the commission places on continuity of service has clearly been evidenced by the manner in which the commission has disposed of renewal applications. And nothing, I might say, in our effort to preserve our grandfather rule in this case is intended to immunize any licensee from continuing to have to pass the commission's scrutiny every 3 years and to be judged on their performance.
Well, was diversity involved in each one of these renewals?
I'm not sure.
I think most of us have familiarity with renewals and applications, and sometimes, you know, renewals are almost perfunctory.
I'm not sure.
Aren't they?
Well, Mr. Justice Marshall,
I'm not speaking about FCC, but in others, isn't that possible?
That may be true in other agencies,
but it couldn't be in FCC.
The commission is obligated by the statute.
But it couldn't be in FCC.
Well, I would not want to concede that we have not followed our statutory mandate to make a public interest finding, although
I have difficulty with, suppose it happens that in this town there's one radio station, one television station, and one newspaper in a town the size of Washington. And it's been renewed for the last 10 times. It automatically has a grandfather clause.
It means that it will not, there are certain small market cases which Washington wouldn't include. So if it's a larger market, it means that that applicant will not be required to divest because of the cross-ownership factor. It does not mean that that applicant 3 years from now will get a renewal. That applicant will get a renewal only if the commission, upon judging the applicant's record of performance, makes public interest
finding. That's true with or without this rule.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All that this rule does
is tend to insulate him, doesn't it?
All that this rule does is tend to give the applicant a chance to have his future fate as a broadcaster, if he wants to continue, determined on the basis of his record of performance and not on the basis of the fact that he is a cross-owner. That's all it does. And in addition to our justification, which we think was rationally explained, and our right to say that continuity outweighs a presumed gain in diversity, we also rely on the doctrine that this result of grandfathering is so clearly rational in terms of our legal system's bias against retroactive applications of new policies that it really didn't require a great deal of explanation. And it's consistent with what the Commission's licensing policy has been over the years. It's consistent with what we've done In past instances, when we have adopted rules that are designed to further diversity by limiting multiple ownership, with almost without exception.
Is it inconceivable that after 5 years' experience, or any number of years you want to pick, the Commission might come to substantially the same conclusion that the Court of Appeals came to now in a rulemaking proceeding?
It is conceivable, Mr. Chief Justice, that
on the basis of experience,
the Commission, on the basis of experience 5 years from now, might reach a judgment that it should order more extensive divestiture and give more weight to diversity than it felt it was able to do on the basis of the record in this proceeding, because this record didn't establish a strong showing, and the Commission relied on that heavily. And clearly, intervening experience might change the nature of the record. That was a very important part of the Commission's balancing process.
Mr. Armstrong, could I ask you what's your view of the relative position of the relative function of the Department of Justice and of your office is in this case? Do you think your relative position is governed by Section 2348 of Title 28?
Yes, sir. I believe that's the provision we are relying upon in order for our authority to file
I'm sure that it looks like you certainly have authority, but what about the Department of Justice?
Well, it's our view that, like the National Citizens Committee for Broadcasting, they were a party with a very strong policy preference as to how the Commission should have weighed the competing considerations which were before it in the case
so
of existing
you would
stations.
So you would say that under 2348, the Attorney General, for example, could have instituted the entire review proceeding before the Court of Appeals, just disagreeing with the...
Initially, I might say in this case, the Department of Justice did file United States versus FCC. They later withdrew it. I believe the Court of Appeals denied a motion by the National Association of Broadcasters to strike them as a petitioner.
On so the basis you don't of that question authority, at all the authority of the I'm sure you disagree with them on the result, but you don't question at all their authority to take a position contrary to yours with respect to divestiture.
Question their authority to tell us that they wished we'd given more weight to the presumed gain in diversity and less weight to the other
considerations. Or to appear in this court.
Or to appear in this court.
What if the Federal Communications Commission had turned down the United States motion to intervene? Do you think they would still have any standing to challenge anything in the Court of Appeals other than the Commission's denial of the motion to intervene?
Your Honor's question is a good question, and I must say I haven't focused on that question. We, from our point of view, from time to time, have considered whether it was appropriate for them to be opposing the Commission on a broad scale in the courts, and I would like to reserve my opportunity at some future occasion to make that argument, but I must say I can't be very enlightening to Your Honor on that point.
Your position, I take in response to Mr. Justice White, is that since the Commission allowed them to intervene, just like they allowed a number of private groups to intervene, they have at least the standing.
Yes, sir. At least we'll go so far as to say, under the circumstances where they were a party with a strong policy pitch before the Commission, either as a statutory respondent or as a petitioner, they probably should be allowed to make that argument.
Mr. Armstrong, but regardless of all of that, you recognize their right to intervene in this court at any time, don't you?
I would guess, sir. Yes, sir.
You do more than recognize that. You insist on it, don't you, Mr. Armstrong? You would assert it affirmatively.
Certainly. In many instances, we would have to rely upon
that. Why
well,
does the Department of Justice have a right to intervene in a suit between two private parties? That's a reason. Why do you concede that?
I may have...
A suit between two private parties. Why is there a right on the part
well,
of the
Well, I didn't
understand.
I misunderstood Mr. Justice Marshall's question to be in that context. I was thinking of it more in terms of a case where a governmental agency was involved, and there's some authority. It may not be correct, but we've been led to believe that in some of our cases, for example, Section 402B of our Act, as opposed to Section 402A, which is governed by the Judicial Review Act, and that's the case we're here on now. But if it's a licensing case, we've been led to believe that if we don't get proper treatment in our view from the Court of Appeals, we have to have the Solicitor General signing our petition for cert.
That's a different.
That's what I had in mind.
That's what I meant.
Yes, sir.
Where do you find that?
The question was
the statute says the Attorney General is responsible for and has control of the interests of the government in all court proceedings in this chapter. Then it goes on to say the agency has the right to be represented by it.
That's in, well, Mr. Justice White, as I understand it, that
you
is.
You don't think that includes the power to make the decision to take certain
action? Well, in a 402A case under our statute, that's specifically governed by Title 28, and the section you've read clearly gives us the right to come here, as we've done in this case, without the department.
Well,
we have another
even,
statute.
Even to bring the petition for surgery.
Yes, sir.
But you did. You filed it.
Yes, sir. But there's another case in our statute, 47 U.S.C. Section 402B, which does not appear to be governed by Title 28 in just a classic licensing case as opposed to rulemaking. And there we've been given an opinion by the department that they must file.
Well, just a minute, counsel. It's one thing, isn't it, to say that you may come here only with the permission of the Solicitor General. And it's quite another thing to say that the Solicitor General may come here regardless of any statutory authorization just because he feels like coming.
Well, I would qualify the answer I gave to Mr. Justice Marshall to say that we're thinking of the case that I just described to you where they would be coming here advocating the position that we had advocated in the Court of Appeals.
And could come as amicus curiae without the consent of anybody.
I believe the federal rules do provide for that. Yes, sir.
Wallace.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm here representing the United States, which is a statutory party in these proceedings, and and probably would have a right to intervene because the constitutionality of an act of Congress as applied has been challenged. However, there was no need to exercise such a right in this case.
Mr. Wallace, aren't you ordinarily expected to uphold the act of the Congress that's challenged under that section?
Yes. We're not attacking the constitutionality of any act of Congress in our submission to this Court.
But I thought you said that was one of the authorities by which you were here.
We could. We didn't have to seek to intervene for that purpose.
Well, and therefore we don't
need to decide
that question.
We're a statutory party. That is correct. Under Section 307 of the Communications Act, the Federal Communications Commission is to grant applications for broadcast licenses if the public convenience, interest, or necessity will be served thereby. And for more than 30 years, in both rulemaking and licensing proceedings, the Commission has recognized that this standard requires it to take into account in issuing licenses the interests of the public in diversity of ownership of the media of communications. And among the factors that it has historically considered for this purpose in comparative proceedings over the years has been an applicant's ownership of a daily newspaper in the locality to be served by the broadcasting license. In this respect, the Commission is charged not to be neutral, but to make an inquiry as to what will serve the public interest under the statutory standard. And one of the components of the public interest is a diversity of ownership of the media of communications and divergent voices to be heard. The present rule before this Court is an effort to deal with the newspaper broadcast co-ownership in a question in a more systematic way. It is not a rule that disqualifies newspaper owners from being licensees of broadcast stations. The rule applies only to co-ownership of a newspaper and a broadcast facility in the same community. Newspaper owners are not disqualified under this rule from ownership of broadcast stations, from licensing broadcast stations. No one owns particular airwaves, but from being licensees of broadcast stations in other communities. And that is an important distinction to keep in mind here. It's illustrated very well by the recent exchange between the Detroit News and the Washington Post of television stations in those two cities. which will result in a dissolution of two of the co-ownership situations that were before the commission when it was considering this rule, by means of the kind of swapping that the commission anticipated could occur without in any way making newspaper owners as such ineligible to be licensees of broadcasting stations. But by applying the public interest standard in the licensing of broadcasting stations so as to increase or at least protect against diminishing the diversity of voices to be heard in that community based on a finding of the commission, based on its experience and much evidence that was before it, that the public looks primarily to these two sources, to its daily newspapers and its local broadcasting stations, and particularly its local television stations, for its news and for its information on public affairs. And this is accentuated with respect to local news affairs. Now, the handling of this matter by the adoption of a rule, rather than case by case as it has been handled over the years, is entirely appropriate to facilitate business planning and to enable the Commission to bring about required changes as a result of reconsiderations of its earlier policies in which it has granted some co-ownerships of co-located stations, cross-ownerships, by means of what has been referred to in these proceedings as divestiture rather than what has been referred to as forfeiture of licenses. And it's important that any retrospective application that the Commission was considering here was not to be achieved by means of simply forfeiting the value of the license and the goodwill at the time a renewal would come up 2 or 3 years hence by holding a comparative proceeding and simply awarding the license to another applicant so that the licensee would be able to realize only the physical value of its assets as a result. The Commission was concerned with protecting licensees against this result by providing a means whereby they would have a reasonable period to swap stations or otherwise to realize the market value of their licenses, all with a view toward what the Commission has over the years, we think legitimately recognized to be a component of the public interest standard, that it should provide incentives for superior public service, incentives to get people to devote their financial resources and their professional endeavors to providing a superior service without the risk of having to start from scratch when they have provided such a service every 3 years in a comparative proceeding against others, if the public is to be well served. And this interest was the Commission undertook to protect this interest by proceeding in a rulemaking proceeding rather than merely applying from case to case the new insights and the further insights that it has developed into the problem of concentration of ownership of the media and the problems that it has presented that have come to its attention over the years. And it further sought to protect these interests by specifying that it would certify transfers that resulted from the divestiture provisions that it would adopt, and it did adopt some, as the Court has been informed, for favorable tax treatment under Section 1071 of the Internal Revenue Code in order to further protect those interests because the transfers were being ordered in the public interest. And a waiver provision was also adopted under which claims of particular hardship could be heard with a view toward possibly extending the time in individual cases and the like. So the rule that has been adopted insofar as it applies prospectively, seems to us to be a valid and reasonable way to apply this, the public interest standard that the Commission long has been applying under the Act based on the commerce power of Congress. And the divestitures that were ordered under that rule, we also think were valid, regardless of how one views the refusal to order the further divestitures. In that respect, we disagree with the Court of Appeals. We think the Commission did have authority, based on the considerations that were before it, to recognize that especially severe problems existed in communities in which there were, for example, only one daily newspaper and one television station, where there would be a mutual inhibition on cross-criticism between the two major media in the community, which in itself would leave the community without any independent voice to criticize the impact that those media have on the community and the effect on its affairs. We think that this is an egregious consideration that the Commission properly did recognize. We disagree with the Court of Appeals that there was no rational basis for singling out those particular examples. We don't believe, however, that the grandfathering that the Commission has adopted with respect to the other existing cross ownerships was rationally justified by the considerations that the Commission itself chose to rely on. On the Commission's own terms, we don't think the lines that it has drawn, the basic differentiation it has introduced between the existing cross ownerships and the future license questions, including transfers, has been rationally justified. And before turning to the reasons why the Commission's justifications don't stand up, it's important, I think, to recognize that very important interests are at stake here in what the Commission has decided. There's not only the public interest that this Court has recognized in the Associated Press case and in other cases dealing with the First Amendment aspects of regulation in this area, in the area of news media, the public interest in the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources as it was put there. But there were a number of examples before the Commission of disadvantages flowing from cross ownership or safeguards from having an independent voice to which the Commission was surely entitled to give weight. Without going into great detail about them, examples were cited to the Commission of a joint operating agreement being negotiated.
Mr. Wallace, may I interrupt you for a moment? You're now arguing against the Commission's grandfathering provision.
Yes.
And you're saying that there were examples before it to which it was entitled to give weight.
That
doesn't make sense to me. It seems to me you have to make a stronger case than that.
Well, I'm about to. I'm using this as an introduction to the deficiencies because I think it's important to recognize what was at stake before the Commission. The
but kinds if it was entitled to give weight, if
well,
it was entitled it, not to give weight.
It obviously gave some weight to these, or it wouldn't have adopted the prospective rule in order to the divestitures that it did. One of the constraints upon an administrative agency is consistency in its treatment of various parties subject to its jurisdiction, Mr. Justice. And that is one of the problems with which we're presented here, and I want to highlight that in just a moment.
But that consistency concept doesn't prevent a regulatory agency from having a change of mind or heart over a period of time, does it?
Not at all. The Internal
Revenue Service.
But it does have to base its the way it applies that change on rational grounds that that don't treat individuals arbitrarily based on factors that are unrelated rationally to the basis on which the agency has changed its position. Well, I want to just mention one or two examples that were before the commission and to which it obviously gave some weight in adopting the prospective rule and the divestiture requirement that it did. One was an example of joint operating agreements that had been the subject of negotiation between the daily newspapers in a city and which were being opposed by labor unions and others in the community, and where allegations were made that the television station owned by one of those newspapers presented no news concerning those agreements in their negotiation until they were consummated, and that to have done so would have been against the economic interests of the newspaper that owned the television station. Another example was editorial support in the local newspapers for a particular location for a museum to be built in the city, which location was close to where the newspapers were being published, where there was considerable sentiment for the museum to be located elsewhere, which was brought out only in an independently operated television station in that community, and was not allegedly covered in the particular papers involved there. These are examples, and the idea is not whether the particular examples were accurate, but they were the kinds of dangers that the commission had before it and obviously had in mind in its concern about cross ownerships here. The other factor to keep in mind is that the rule, the prospective rule that the commission did adopt, does have an effect on existing combinations. This is not a bright line between a prospective rule and a retrospective rule. It has an effect on existing combinations by a process of gradual attrition of existing cross-ownerships at the time they are transferred for value. And for example, when the Washington Star in this city was sold within recent years, the transfer policy was applied to it, and the co-owned television station could not be transferred to the same owner. The result was a dissolution of that ownership where the competitive daily newspaper, the Washington Post, was allowed to continue to have its locally owned, co-located, commonly owned television station. This introduces a disparity between newspapers in the same community, which is a serious matter. I don't say that it's an unconstitutional disparity, that it's not something that Congress could have adopted, but it is a disparity in treatment in a constitutionally sensitive area which impels us to take a careful look at the reasons given by the commission.
That disparity would be wholly correctable within a maximum of 3 years if the commission thought that that disparity was a controlling reason for not granting a renewal of the application.
It could be, but the commission is under considerable inhibition at renewal time to engage in what it considers to be a forfeiture of the applicant's license when the applicant is providing good service.
The commission is, you're arguing now that the commission was compelled not to have a grandfather clause.
Well, I'm arguing that the commission, there are particularly strong reasons to see whether the commission's grandfather clause was rationally based, whether the grounds that it gave for adopting the grandfather clause stand up on the commission's own premises. That's all I'm arguing, not that the commission was compelled to have a grandfather clause.
If it had this prospective rule, it was compelled to have a grandfather clause. That's what I thought your argument was.
Well, we have said that...
Am I mistaken?
I believe you are, Mr. Justice. We have taken the position in our brief that the Court of Appeals went too far.
Oh, and requiring a rule.
And that the commission, if it can rationally justify a grandfathering, is entitled to adopt a grandfathering provision. We're saying a remand is needed here because the explanations which the commission offered do not rationally justify the grandfathering that it adopted.
Are not rational. Mr. Wallace, what about the local ownership point, which is the first one they make? Why is that irrational? Is it that it's so improbable that it will have an impact on local ownership, or in the alternative, are you arguing that it's irrational to have local ownership be a factor to consider? Which are you?
We're arguing several points in response to that. One is that the commission has not repudiated its long-standing policy of not giving very heavy weight to local ownership as such.
Has it ever said it was totally zero factor?
It has never said it was totally zero.
It doesn't have to be.
Number
that
two
to be
is that one quarter of the co-ownerships that it is grandfathering are not locally owned. It doesn't really support the grandfathering of those particular ones. A third point is that there was.
Would you concede it's rational as to the three quarters?
A third point is that there was nothing before the commission. There was nothing.
What about
well,
that,
it just
Mr.
shows
Wallace?
That they weren't really they weren't really relying on it.
Well,
a
but,
third
but,
point
Mr.
is.
Listen, please answer my question, if you would. They did set it as a reason. They said they were relying on it. We have to assume they wrote that opinion in good faith. And you say it does apply to three quarters of the existing licensees. Is it irrational as applied to those three quarters?
Yes, because there was nothing before the commission to show that local ownership would be diminished by...
But was it irrational to conclude that it might be? And that's all they held. And you gave an example earlier in your argument of the Washington-Detroit swap where it took place. So how can you say it's irrational to assume that it might take place?
The commission has approved many transfers over the years which resulted in diminution of local ownership, as I expect they will approve the Washington-Detroit transfer. And there was no evidence before the commission that local ownership, that there weren't eligible local owners to come forward to be transferees of these licenses if the commission were to require that they be transferred to locally owned interests, or if the commission wanted to give particular weight to that factor. The commission certainly did not give any weight to a requirement that local owners be found in the instances in which it was requiring divestiture.
You don't need any sort of evidence in a rulemaking proceeding, do you?
No, but you need a rational ground for belief that what you're worried about will be diminished by the particular course of action.
But isn't the commission presumed to have some competence and expertise which can supply that rational ground unless it's just patently fallacious?
It does have some expertise in this area, but there is nothing on the face of either commission practice or what the commission purported to rely on or what was before it to indicate that local ownership would be preserved by the grandfathering, or was of sufficient concern to the commission that they were taking any step to assure transfers to local owners where they were requiring divestiture. In other words, as we said in our brief, that particular element was a make-weight. I think Mr. Firestone will deal with the other grounds relied upon by the commission and why we don't think they rationally justified the order that it adopted. And I do believe the court should keep in mind that in 1943, at the time the commission adopted the rule against co-located AM stations, it did not grandfather, it did not introduce the kind of disparities that it is introducing here in the example that I gave between two different newspapers in the same community.
Mr. Firestone, somewhere in the course of your discussion, if you find it convenient, and if you think it's relevant, would you relate what the Commission has done here to its situation that has been mentioned, requiring a divestiture by the star of its broadcast license and permitting, even though it is true that any other licensee is up for renewal, but one was mandatory and one is still open.
Yes, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I'm Charles Firestone from the National Citizens Committee for Broadcasting, which, of course, does seek affirmance of the Court's decision. I have 3 points I want to make, and during the course of that time, I do hope to address that point. First, I'd like to follow through on the Deputy Solicitor General's arguments about why it was arbitrary and capricious and answer Mr. Justice Rehnquist's question about the need for a record. It's the point is here, I think, that the Congress has ordered the agencies under the Administrative Procedure Act to be not to be arbitrary and capricious, and that is really the basis of this court reversal, that simply that the Commission was arbitrary and capricious in the way that they treated the various issues before them.
That's quite different than saying it's not supported by substantial record substantial evidence.
Yes.
It's arbitrary and capricious. A rule can survive the arbitrary and capricious test without an iota of evidence having been introduced for the Commission, may it not?
Well, we believe that the if there is absolutely no record support and no basis for coming to suppositions, that it could rise to the level of being arbitrary.
Isn't it difficult to find arbitrary capricious on a 5-year period of time?
Your Honor, the place where it was arbitrary and capricious was the Commission's failure to order divestiture, and to failure to apply its prospective rule. They applied they set a standard here,
but
in their
it was
discretion.
5 years they worked on.
The 5-year standard.
So how can you say that's arbitrary and capricious?
That the 5-year standard
might be arbitrary, but it sure is hard to say it's capricious.
The 5-year standard is not what we say is arbitrary and capricious. What happened here is that the Commission used totally unsupported conjectures. They applied standards which were inconsistent with past Commission practices and which are inconsistent with the Communications Act. A second point I hope to make in my argument is that the issue of discretion, that the Court remanded the case to the Commission, contemplating that the Commission would have discretion when the case was remanded. Of course, the agency has great discretion in this area. And in fact, the Court restored discretion to the Commission in the very important area of renewals. The Commission took away its own discretion by its ad hoc standard in considering allegations, structural allegations of concentration of control. This, the Commission said, concentration of control is a primary licensing factor.
And the court did seem, at least in its words, to require that the Commission issue a rule in this area.
Well,
you would concede
to the extent
that,
orders the rule, I think we would concede that the Commission does have authority, have
not
wide
to
discretion.
Have any rule at all.
To have no rule at all. And finally,
well, is there a difference when they go partway down the road and not all the way?
Yes, Your Honor, there is a difference there.
Isn't that what the Court of Appeals was pointing to?
They pointed to it, but I suppose that if the Commission acted rationally, and the Court of Appeals pointed out many errors. This decision was riddled with error at the agency level. The Court of Appeals pointed out many of the errors, and I would not presume to be able to figure out how the Commission is going to treat it. They do have wide discretion, but it seems to me conceivable that as long as they are not arbitrary and on remand, that they may adopt no rule. Now, that might mean no prospective rule as well. I'm not sure. But if they do adopt a prospective rule, as they did here, and in their discretion found that nothing can be more important than ensuring that there is a free flow of information, the public's right to know that it derives from, but not just the First Amendment. It also derives from Section 303G of the Communications Act, which is at page A29 of the Joint Appendix, where it says Congress mandated the Commission to promote the larger and more effective use of radio. The NBC, the court in NBC, said that this included a concern about monopolization of the media. But the Commission did come out with a standard. They said that it is unrealistic to expect true diversity from newspaper broadcast station combinations. And therefore, in looking only to the broadcasting stations, and they're not trying to regulate newspapers, they treat newspapers the same as they treat television stations to the extent that you cannot own two television stations in the same market. And they look to the equality, more or less, in terms of where people get most of their news and information. But when it came time to apply this to renewal, the Commission, even though there's a 3-year limit on a renewal set by Congress, and even though the Communications Act requires them to or mandates them to have use the larger and more effective use of radio. The commission moved to immunize existing licensees from structural challenge on the basis of concentration of control. And on these three points that the commission used to override this strong factor of diversity, the commission itself has said that diversity is the primary licensing factor. And yet they look to these three overriding factors to this diversity criterion. And the first, Mr. Justice Stevens, and with regard to local ownership, the first thing that the commission did was ban local ownership in the prospective rule. If a local newspaper wants to acquire a local television station, they cannot do it. The factor of diversity overrode. Secondly, as...
I didn't bar local ownership. Yeah. I just barred local ownership by a newspaper.
Right. But certainly here, what it showed is that they preferred the criterion of diversity over local ownership for the prospective rule, but turned it around and used this criterion to override diversity for existing licensees when 25% of them were not even local owners. Secondly, the commission only looks to local ownership traditionally, and in the 1965 policy statement on renewals, they only look at it to the extent that there's integration of ownership into management. And here, the broadcasters claimed that the newspaper owners were not integrated into the management of the stations, and the commission relied on that. They said, were they not separately run, they would require far many more.
Well, doesn't the commission's reliance here supersede whatever they said in 1965?
Except that they have not disavowed. They have not perhaps they could supersede it, but they didn't do it here. They didn't really explain what they were doing here.
Well, if every agency, when it changes its mind, had to get out all of its other inconsistent statements that have been made over the last 40 years, we would never adjourn for the summer.
That's true, but there are internal inconsistencies here, and also they didn't really treat this issue of integration. What they're talking about, they're saying local owners, and they didn't really go into this. But when you look at other commission law over the years, they didn't intend to overrule this issue of integration. They just didn't deal with it. And it just goes to the arbitrariness of the commission's decision here.
Mr. Firestone, I know the newspapers argued that they were not involved in the management of the station as much. Did the commission so find?
The commission stated that were it not that case, were there not separate ownership, they would require far many more divestitures. They did not actually make a finding that they didn't look into it anymore. They basically relied on these representations.
Are you saying that it would be irrational to attach any weight at all to the requirement of local ownership unless the local owner were actively involved in management?
Under existing commission law, unless the commission had changed...
Let's follow Mr. Justice Rehnquist's suggestion. Maybe all the past commission law has been irrational. The question is whether this particular ruling was rational, isn't it? And would it be irrational for the commission to attach some weight to a factor of local ownership, even though the local owner were not actively involved in management? Isn't that the question?
I don't think it's the question, but if it were, I don't think it's
well,
the question.
Well, unless we mean different things by irrationality. That's,
no,
there are different kinds of irrationality.
No, I think that the question here is, has the commission been internally inconsistent? Have they been inconsistent with prior policies without explaining their
departure
from prior
norms? Whenever you find inconsistency, do you necessarily find irrationality? Is that your view?
I think that it raises the question of irrationality.
You're going to say some unkind things about this court,
I think. I think inconsistency raises the question of irrationality, but here, if they had some reason for the inconsistency, that would be one thing, but they didn't explain any reason for that, and they just mentioned it. In fact, in this case, they actually purported to be following past policy. They alluded to the 1965 policy statement. And I don't think that it was their intention to retreat from that integration into ownership and of ownership into management factor. Second, the issue of local economic dislocations was another example. First of all, whether it was totally
Let me just ask one other question, Mr. Firestone. On remand, I take it would not be open to the commission to rewrite in its opinion entirely and say, well, we reviewed the entire matter from a new angle, we overruled a lot of prior decisions, we now conclude upon fresh review that the grandfather clause is proper and the prospective rule is proper both. Maybe they could, in other words, could they write a better opinion and still sustain the rule under the Court of Appeals mandate?
Under the Court of Appeals mandate, The quick answer to your question is I do think the commission could rewrite the opinion.
And reach the same result?
And reach the same result It's very hard to determine. I can't really determine that.
If you assume they could have written a better opinion and reached the same result, you must be assuming it's not totally irrational.
Right, but I think that they can be. That's, I think, the Chenery idea
but the remand isn't a Chenery remand. It isn't a remand to say, go ahead and restate your reasons. Your reasons don't adequately support the conclusion. If I understand it, the remand is to carry out the direction of the Court of Appeals as to what the rule should be.
Well, we don't read that decision. We read the decision, for instance, in footnote 53 to contemplate that there might be a totally different rule, even prospective rule, in terms of a 30% criterion, as was suggested by some people, including some of the parties here. But on the getting on to the local economic dislocations criterion, the Commission says we are afraid that, in fact, they don't make it clear again. We're not sure what they've said, except that the Council explains that they say that they're concerned about reinvestment of our having enough money due to increased interest rates. They were concerned that interest rates would increase if there was a widespread divestiture, and they were concerned that there would be enough money to invest into programming. And yet the Commission specifically has refused to look at this question in licensing cases. And the Alianza case, which we cite, is an example where the Court of Appeals has affirmed the Commission's refusal to look into this criterion in the public interest. Now they're using that criterion to override their strong interest in diversity of communications sources. Similarly with continuity of ownership. There, of course, the licensee just minimally served the public interest over the years. Mr. Armstrong says, well, the longevity of their service is a factor that really matters. But if their service hasn't been good, it may be that the new licensee will do a much better job. And in the WHDH case, the one time when a newspaper television broadcaster, cross-owner, was replaced with a new applicant, that new applicant or that new licensee has performed excellently, superior service throughout, and it's recognized throughout the country to that effect. Now, of course, broadcasters do take their license subject to renewal at the time, subject to the rules in effect at the time of renewal. And a license can last no longer than 3 years. They run on their record. And you can't have the record go on for, say that because they did a great job 20 years ago but haven't done a good job the last 3 years, that doesn't mean anything, and it hasn't in the past in the Commission decisions. But the key fact here is that the Commission did not really come to a systematic evaluation of the record. They didn't really look at their own past precedent. They didn't look at, and there are internal inconsistencies in the order. And now, with respect to the issue of discretion, in answer to Mr. Chief Justice's question with respect to the Washington Star, of course, there they applied, the Commission's rule applies to transfers. The Washington Star was in bad shape, according to their allegations, and they needed an influx of money, and it amounted to a transfer of control. The licensee basically would have continued with the Washington Star and WMAL, the radio and television stations. Yet the Commission's rule prospectively said that this is a sale and the public interest is not served by the acquisition of a TV and a newspaper or broadcast TV.
But if that basic principle is true, why doesn't it apply to the existing situations of any others?
That's exactly our contention, that it should. And in fact, what it does, what they have done is applied a public interest standard to transfers, which they refuse to apply to renewals. And yet it's the same public interest standard. Now, maybe there are factors that can override this diversity criterion with respect to renewal applicants. The Commission did not really and rationally deal with that. And they threw out some reasons, but really the Commission had a goal here, and they've stated the goal as diversifying the media, of promoting diversification. And yet what it has done is turned around and protected existing licensees against challenge and against the application of this public interest standard at renewal time. And I'd like to give an example, what I would consider a better example in terms of this issue, and that is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. There was, in 1975, a newspaper monopoly owned by one family, the only newspapers in town, the only VHF station in town, 2 of 5 radio stations, a cable television system, of which it was co-owned. They owned 60%. The 40% owner owned 2 of the remaining 3 radio stations in town. It was grandfathered because there was an incoming signal from a station assigned to Lebanon and Lancaster, hyphenated market. And this was a UHF signal. Now, in a consideration on that renewal of that Lancaster station, the commission would not allow a showing that the one incoming signal was not a significant signal, that 15,000 people could not really obtain that signal. They would not allow a showing as to the inapplicability of any of these criteria, such as local ownership, such as continuity or local economic dislocations. They wouldn't even allow a showing as to the Sherman Act violation, an allegation of Sherman Act violation, which the commission said was its standard. They would not allow a showing because they said they're not equipped to administer the antitrust laws. It was a catch-22 there. And finally, under their reconsideration order, under the commission standards, if that UHF signal went dark tomorrow, of course, the situation has since changed, but if that signal went dark, the commission said in reconsideration that it would not require divestiture even in that event, even though it met this standard of egregiousness that they required divestiture for the 16, because they said they're concerned about uncertainty. They didn't want the licensees to feel uncertain. Your Honor, if I can just sum up, I think that the basis here is the First Amendment interest in diversity of information sources. As Judge Leonard Hand said, to some it may be folly, but we have staked upon it our all. Thank you.
Mr. Griswold, you had some observations right at the outset of your argument about the unconstitutionality of saying a newspaper can't have the same rights as anyone else. Would you apply that proposition to what I've just been discussing with Mr. Firestone on the Star? The Federal Communications Commission, it appears, said to the Star, you, the new owners of the Star, you cannot have this television station. Under your theory, as you outlined it at the outset, that would be unconstitutional, wouldn't it?
If done by a blanket rule which prevents the consideration of all of the facts and circumstances with respect to that particular case.
It was a blanket rule.
In this case, it is a blanket rule.
In the Star case.
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I don't understand the case that you're...
Well, when a new owner bought the Star, he had to divest the television license ultimately. When a new owner bought the Star
Washington Star.
WMAL together.
I think that, of course, as far as I know, is the only case, or at least the only prominent case, which actually exists under this rule. And I think it shows, among other things, that this rule does not promote diversity. What has happened by taking the ownership by a newspaper into account in a particular case with respect to the Boston Herald has been to destroy the Boston Herald. And what may happen with respect to the rule as applied to the Washington Star may be to destroy the Washington Star. And my contention is that the commission not only has no authority under its existing statute to make a rule applicable only to newspapers, but that it may well be unconstitutional in doing so. In particular, in dealing with the final case to which Mr. Firestone referred, I would like to suggest that there's nothing about that in the record of this case, and if the commission was in error in that case, it should come up in that case on that record.
Are you suggesting that that constitutionally the prospective rule might survive, but the divestiture rule might not?
No, Mr. Justice. I think that constitutionally the prospective rule should not.
Oh, I understand. I understand. But could you conceive of the one surviving and not the other?
Oh, I can conceive it, yes. But my position is that the prospective rule is not constitutional. There is no previous case which applies any statute or any rule of the commission to newspapers, to all newspapers, and only to newspapers. A reference has been made to the NBC case. That involved the question of affiliation of a station with a network, completely broadcast. The Storer case involved multiple ownership of broadcast stations, only broadcast.
Well, why should the owner of a broadcast station be forbidden from acquiring another just because he's a broadcaster?
Mr. Justice, I think that that was probably settled as long ago as the Federal Radio Commission case in 1930.
Well, it may, was it settled right?
The Pottsville case in 1994, yes, I think so.
Well, and why, the, then? I ask you
and
why.
And the Red Lion case in which I appeared in 7 or 8 years ago, for better or for worse, the court has taken the role. I'm inclined to think for the better, though it's an awful close question, that there is something about broadcasting involving the limitation of the spectrum, which makes it appropriate for the government to introduce regulation. There is no such rule with respect to the press, and that is the position we take here.
That gets back to my inquiry long ago about the scarcity of newspaper.
Yes, there's a greater scarcity of newspapers now, and there may be more. The next step here will be barring all newspapers everywhere. They talk about swapping, but if you can do this, you can make a rule which says that no newspaper can own a television station. We think that this was in effect covered by the Grosjean case.
Mr. Griswold, supposing we had a situation in which Congress repealed the Sherman Act, then passed a new statute and said that it should be unlawful for newspapers to enter into agreements and restrain a trade. Would that be constitutional?
Yes, Mr. Justice.
It would be a law directed at newspapers and no one else.
I'm quite sure it would. That it seems to me, is exactly what the court decided in the Grosjean case, where it held that a tax applicable only to newspapers was invalid. And as this court has said with respect to that, in the Oklahoma Press case, the singling out of the press for different treatment from that accorded other businesses in general is invalid.
Well, you mean the statute would be unconstitutional?
The statute would be unconstitutional. That's what I thought I said.
No, you said it would be valid. In other words, you say if there were a statute, we repeal the Sherman Act, we pass a new statute and say that monopolies and restraints of trade in the newspaper business are hereby forbidden. You say that's unconstitutional.
Mr. Justice, I think that any legislation by Congress which is applicable only to newspapers would almost inevitably be a violation of the First Amendment.
Well, of course it
unless maybe it gives them something.
Yes, I was just going to say. I was just going to call your attention to the Newspaper Preservation Act.
You're
which,
a good lawyer.
Which permitted.
Well, I've always been troubled by the Newspaper Preservation Act, and that, of course, is a step in the direction of easing the antitrust laws, giving them something. And as long as the antitrust laws are applicable to newspapers and the labor relations laws have also been held to be applicable to newspapers, I would suppose that Congress can minimize the situations in which those statutes apply.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.